Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Polly Clark, author of your debut novel, Larchfield.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Tell us the story of Larchfield in your words.
Larchfield's got two stories, actually, that my big task and what I found was the journey of writing the book was to make the two stories one story, because I knew from the very beginning that these two people, the poet W.H. Auden and my heroine Dora, were meant to be together, that these two stories had something massive in common, but I didn't know what it was. And all the things, all the kind of voices in my head and anyone I showed it to, they were more saying, look, you know, you've got W.H. Auden as someone to write about. He had lived in Helensburgh, my hometown. Really, why? Are you sure you need the other bit? Are you sure you need Dora? You know, and her, you know, really quite hard story. You know, wouldn't you just like to write about Auden? That'll be a lovely, kind of really interesting new take on Helensburgh. So I had a lot of voices in my head saying that they weren't meant together, but an absolute conviction that they were meant to be together. And so the journey of writing the book was finding out why they were meant together and seeing what happened when they actually met. And that has been the huge reward of writing it, that's something that I just quietly believed very, very absolutely with all my being did turn out to be true. They were meant to be together.
Dora comes to Helensburgh pregnant, newly married, and with the sort of romantic belief and hope that one, as a poet, she can live anywhere. And, you know, she's very much in love with her husband. She's looking forward to the birth of her child and this new life. And her, almost that bubble is sort of burst almost immediately upon moving into, funnily enough, paradise, mm-hmm. which is the name of their home, which is also a character.
Mm, very much, yeah.
Yeah, it's a specific to Helensburgh, I think, which was a shipping town and had a lot of shipping money, at the time that Auden was there. Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of very large house, but split in two. So. Kind of in the middle of nowhere,
yeah.
And yet with very close neighbors.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's very, it's a very unusual way of living that I hadn't come across before. So I'd come up from England where people tend to live next door to each other. And so to only kind of see these buildings, which because it's, you know, the facades are preserved, so you can't tell that anything's been converted, but generally they're up and down, the conversions are up and down in order to sort of preserve the facade. So I just found that a really unusual way to live. And because, yes, the houses are massive, so they have a lot of space around them, you're both kind of living very grandly and on top of people, but without the kind of city feel that you get if you're in a tenement somewhere, or, you know, that people in the city would understand and feel very comfortable with. So yeah, it creates a sort of very, you know, strange atmosphere, and that's something that seemed really important in the book as well.
Mm. And I got the sense that she, I mean, I felt very close to Dora's story because I moved countries when my son was 6 months old. And I also, like, what I perceived, or perhaps slapped onto Dora, was the sense that I am quite a self-contained person.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dora,
yeah,
lives quite internally.
Yeah.
And felt that, you know, with her sense of self, that she would be fine anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't realize that her inner stability was dependent to some degree, and it was bolstered to some degree by how she was perceived.
Mm.
She didn't realize the degree to that.
Yeah.
That in Oxford she was known as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
That she, you know, she, just how she was perceived was how she perceived herself.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting, yeah.
And that upon moving away from that, even her name changed.
Mm.
Her role changed. And she was not well perceived.
No. Yeah, which leaves so not much to kind of rest on. Yeah, mm-hmm. So definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think she has, you know, sort of... I mean, her trajectory, I think, is in some ways very common for women. Mm-hmm. But it has everything. It has, you know, it's intensified. So the move from one place to another, being married to somebody that, in a way, she doesn't know very well, who does belong where they're going and she doesn't, and a new baby and a hostile environment, you know, so they all come at once. And yes, exactly, it's a huge challenge to an assault on yourself, really. That is what all that is, and what happens to you after that, and can you sustain being a mother, can you sustain being even a person with all those things taken away from you. That was very interesting to me.
Mm. Yeah, because she is assaulted. I don't want to give too much away because I don't want to ruin other people's reading experiences and their sense of discovery. But she is, it is not an easy birth.
No.
Which, again, goes against, it's one other sort of the scales falling from her eyes of how she thought it was going to be.
Mm.
Her neighbors are not how she thought communal living would be, in any sense. Everything. And also, I definitely got the sense that because just having children, motherhood is brutally isolating
mm-hmm.
anyway,
mm-hmm.
both internally and externally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what you're going to be like as a mother because you haven't been a mother.
No.
Until you're a mother.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then to do it in foreign circumstances,
mm-hmm.
to be judging yourself, questioning yourself at a time when you're exhausted, which invites paranoia, which, I mean, the sense of atmosphere that you create is very, very real.
Mm. I feel that that it's the one time that... Yeah, all your authority as a person vanishes overnight. So in the book there are lots of officials, and I mean, I felt this when I had my daughter. Suddenly, like, everybody not only has an opinion, but their opinion has authority, and they you know, somebody that you would never have had to take, you know, sort of any orders from in the past can sort of march into your house, and they have real authority. So that, I think, is another thing. And it's when you're at your most vulnerable. And I feel that, you know, it's a huge shock to kind of enter this almost parallel universe. It felt like a parallel universe where yes, you have no authority, total responsibility, and kind of absence of kindness. That's the thing that I think she notices. You just sort of fall out of the world of kindness, and there's a kind of interest in your child, but the interest in you is that you're sort of an obstacle to people being able to do what they think's best for your child or whatever, mm-hmm. but not do it, actually, because nobody actually wants to do anything. They just want to tell you what to do. So I think all those things together just, yeah, they strip completely. And if you're, as a lot of women my generation, you're doing this much later.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so Dora is, I think, she's 35 when she has her baby. I was older than that even. And yeah, so you're you do have some sense of your own self, and you just don't know what to do.
And that really
whipped away.
Yeah, I have to say that I found even, I think being older was more of a hindrance in that, your sense of self having been so developed.
Absolutely, yes. You almost wish that you just didn't know better. Yeah. If you just, you know, didn't know that life could involve autonomy, it would have made your transition much more smooth. Yeah.
And she's also navigating this with her husband, and, you know, I mean, she, like anyone with a small child, is shackled to the home almost. And, you know, just his very ability to have two arms and go outside,
yeah.
you know, cause resentment.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
And it's really, and again, because they didn't know themselves with a child. Mm-hmm. And he has drivers on his end as well, as anybody does.
Yeah.
And truly, the only person that she reaches out to, meets, comes across, is W.H. Auden, who was just as isolated and persecuted in Hillsborough,
yes,
as she is.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that the writing a book usually comes from some sort of personal driver, and my impetus in the book was you know, that I knew that W.H. Auden had, from the beginning when I moved to that area, I knew that W.H. Auden had been there, but I was actually quite disappointed when I found that out. I mean, it should have been, as a writer, I should have been really excited. But mainly I thought, oh, I wish it was somebody else that I had a direct line to me personally. You know, if Ted Hughes had lived there, or Daphne du Maurier, or somebody that I was just really, really excited about as a writer. I mean, W.H. Auden, I admire him, but we have very little, apart from an artistic sensibility and an interest in the same things, and you know, I appreciate his genius. There's nothing in common, and so the fact that W.H. Auden had been in my town, just sort of sat there for about 8 years, and I did nothing with this, but it was in my mind the whole time. And why can't I? You know, because I'm a magpie. You know, I would be like really, and no one else had done anything about it. You know, his biographers have barely mentioned it, and it was a really formative period of his life. So there was a lot you could do.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. So, at what point in Auden's life did he live there?
So he was 24. And he lived there, it was 1930 to 1932, and it covered a really formative period when he published his first book of poems. So he was already in London and Oxford and wherever, famous by then. That first book
Even
of poems...
Even in Hillsborough.
Well, no. You see, that's the thing. They just thought, you know...
Some poet guy.
Yes, who's obviously a bit dodgy and a bit, you know, has some inclinations that we're not going to look at too closely. But he wrote his first, published his first book of poems, and then he wrote The Orators, which is now thought of as his sort of first work of genius. This is a book-length, crazy document, which has lots of Hillsborough landmarks and everything. And if you see it sort of marketed, it's all very earnest and about the state of the nation and you know, so on. And that's true, I'm sure. But if you came to it as I did, which is... once my story had started to unfold, I had a baby, I did feel quite isolated. I had a story in my mind of a woman in this kind of situation, and I happened to read The Orators then. And then all the fireworks went off, because that book is just a fizzing document of repression and fear and paranoia. This is somebody who is desperate to be himself, because he's an artist, which is it's your main driver in life, is to be authentic, and yet he can't be, and it just twists and distorts everything he's doing. And he's sort of at the same time having a kind of conversation about that and making wider resonances with that. And I read that and just thought, yes, you know, that, so this, that's why he's there. Thank God he's there. He actually is my, don't know what the word is, saviour. This understanding that story is the link between the two stories, and they have everything in common when they superficially have nothing in common. So The Orators is a key text he wrote there, and he also had his first big love affair while he was in Hillsborough. So that was all in 2 years, and it wasn't long after that. So by 1939, he'd gone to America and never came back in any meaningful way. So the whole thing is just such an incredible gift, and I'm just really thankful that I got my wits about me, and you know, in the end realised that that's what it was. Took me a long time.
And how much of his part of the story is fictionalised, or and how much research were you able to do?
I did quite a lot of research. So I went to the British Library, which has his notebooks from when he was in Hillsborough, and they were interesting. they're sort of incomprehensible, but you know, you just got lots of notes that you could see then became the orators. And his biographers do mention, you know, basic facts, so I had a handful of basic facts. And what actually happened with Larchfield, it was the boys' prep school in Helensburgh. There was a corresponding girls' school, St Bride's, and then these were amalgamated into Lohman School in Helensburgh, which I know very well. My daughter goes there. So then there's a certain amount, although they haven't really done much with this kind of history, there were certain little bits of documentation that were there, and photographs. So there's a wonderful photograph of Auden outside the building of Larchfield with his class and everything. It's wonderful. And because everything is preserved, you can drive past that building and it looks exactly the same. And it's the same. I've described it very sort of, closely in the book. But then there was a fire not long after the schools were amalgamated into Lohman. The whole thing burned down. So most of the paperwork was gone, including, you know, any old copies of the Larchfieldian that he did. His biographer, an executor, Edward Mendelssohn, has put out several calls asking people in Helensburgh to look in their attics, because if you could find this copy of the Larchfieldian, apparently he wrote poems for it, and the kids did a play that was printed in there, but it's never turned up. So it was wonderful in that I had a lot of information, but no... very little actual documents that I had to stick to. And the town of Helensburgh is essentially unchanged. It looks the same. And it has a similar quality, social quality, that remains unchanged. In the book, Cecil Day Lewis calls it the Wimbledon of the North. And it still is. Mm. So yeah, I was able... My sort of imagination was able to play along, you know, really helpfully with what I had, but I wasn't constrained. I mean, I changed certain names or whatever, and I've fictionalised. I mean, all the characters are fictionalised, but I've kept some names where they're famous, because obviously he did by that point have famous friends. And it was a wonderful, the sort of research that maybe a writer likes to do. So not, I wasn't constrained by anything, but he really was there. So I had a lot of fun with it.
It's the best of both worlds.
It is,
in that
absolutely.
Sense. Yes.
Yeah, and I really felt actually that the constraints of what was there were enough that I had to really get into what I thought he was. And I did. I mean, maybe a lot of writers feel this, but I felt there was almost an encounter. I mean, you know, Dora has her encounter, and in my own way I feel I did too. That little narrow bit of W.H. Auden, privately, no matter what anyone says, I feel I know pretty well.
That did allow you to, as fully as you create Dora's story, create his story. And it just felt to me, the whole life of that school, the students, the headmaster's wife, that all of those relationships, the benefactor in the town, I mean, that all felt seamless.
Oh, great.
Enveloping, yeah. And as real as Dora's story.
Some of the kind of scenes came out of suggestions of things that were in the orators, so he has a lot of sort of mad people in there and mad sort of odd scenes, and Daphne particularly, who's the headmaster's mm-hmm. wife, who became such a sort of important character. I mean, she is very sort of minor, but she's mentioned, or a person who is like this is mentioned quite a lot in the orators, and I sort of ran with that because she's
a fascinating character.
I loved her. So, their actual kind of trajectories, I don't know so I've made up a lot of stuff, and but it felt very comfortable to sort of do that, because you know, you've got that central figure who you can track through all that.
Mm-hmm. And in the same way that Dora sort of gained a name coming to Helensburgh, I felt that you gave us Winston's name.
Ah, right. Okay.
Because he's so known as W.H. Auden.
That's true.
And I might be idly curious and be like, oh, what is the W.H.
Yeah.
But it's
very
just
unusual
not, yes,
name, isn't it? That was another gift as well, because, you know, Whiston is, I think there's been a Saint Whiston, and that's it. So, you know, there are a couple of moments that kind of really hinge on there only really being one Whiston. So, yeah, that was really fortunate. Yeah, yeah, it's a great name. Dora's name, I mean, there's just so kind of much that it isn't really anything that's been brought out in the book, but it was a private driver to me. She's actually named after Freud's patient, Dora. So the young woman who came to him in one of his famous cases and complained that she was being abused by her father's friend and then later by her father, and Freud, and she had all these physical symptoms, you know, she had paralysis and this and that, and she's telling him that this is what is happening, and he reinterprets it back to her that it's her own secret desires and that she's sort of making all this, you know, happen. Or she's imagining it, and if it is happening, it's because she secretly desires it anyway. And so she's effectively silenced. Mm-hmm. And that I just found that as a really powerful thing of what happens to her gradually. She's just silenced. Yeah, no, fewer and fewer people listen to her, and not even her own husband listens to her.
Eventually, she stops listening.
Yes,
to her.
That's right. Yeah, and then the sheer, you know, power of imagination or. The one person who does is Auden, who superficially at least would have been the last person who would have understood her problem. That was actually very, the naming of things is terribly important in books, isn't it? Yeah, it makes a big difference.
And tell me why, I mean, because obviously there were some autobiographical elements to the book. And I was wondering why, as you are a published poet, why this story and why the autobiographical parts of the story, or even the Auden parts of this story, that you did this in prose. Mm. What about this story needed to be prose and not fiction? I mean, not poetry.
Not poetry. I think it's different forms for different things. And I don't know, I realised that there was a story, and poetry isn't very good for a story. And also that you can, I mean, I've discovered, yes, I mean, it was quite an undertaking to do a novel from poetry. It's, you know, marathon versus sprint, they're different muscles, they're different everything. But what I found is that a novel not just allows you to tell a story, but you can put all your poetry into it as well. I mean, you can, you know, it's such an enormous, capacious form. You know, all your best writing can go in, all your you know, imagery can go in, all your way of thinking in poetic terms can go in, and you can have a story as well. I just had this idea of something that really was a story or had more momentum than could be wrapped up in 40 lines or whatever. And also, I, you know, had the luxury of obscurity and just labouring away and no one really caring what I was doing, so I could just follow that for as long as I needed to do. That was the result. It took a long time, but it was the right form for that thing. I couldn't have wrapped it up so neatly. The poems are, they're very neat. They're very neat and beautiful. And actually, I think the age I am, I think middle age, I'm a middle, I am, I know, but yeah.
Nobody likes to admit it, but
yeah,
here we are.
But it's a really, really big area, middle age. It goes for a long time.
Yes, it's getting longer all the time.
Yes, having begun my middle age. I just think it's a period of life that it has a lot of grey in it, and ambivalence and black and white exist at the same time. It's the life of, it's being able to manage a life that involves reconciling opposites at all times, whereas when you're young that's not done. And I think that is the purity of life without having to reconcile opposites is the time of poetry. I think a bit like how young people often do their best maths when they're young. There's something, you know, the purity of things being either this or that is very suited to poetry, and then something more complex that can look at things in the round. This form has come to me much more naturally at this age.
And it's interesting that the two poets finding their connection would, as you say, in poetry, it wouldn't be neat.
No.
And it wouldn't be as obvious as it becomes in prose.
Yes, and as well, there's the difficulty of, like, you know, W.H. Auden is famous, and my character is fictional and a woman and not famous, and you could get into this real sort of mess of, like, you know, sort of Shakespeare's sister type of idea. Is she as good as him? And just not, you know, it could have just gone down a whole road that wasn't actually what I was interested in. They have a sensibility, you know, the artistic sense of poetic sensibility is what they each seize on, or she see, you know, but I haven't, the story I wanted to tell wasn't about their actual poetry. That could have been a very, very difficult, hopeless task to get into all that.
Well, yes, because it also allows, obviously, their story is crafted by you, but it allows, and there's a lot of you in it, but it allows you to take you out of it.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Let it be their story.
Yeah, yes, and I'm interested in life, and you know, that what I've done with or for Auden. Yeah, I mean, he's a person in my, well, that's what I've wanted to make, is, you know, I've tried to restore her to personhood, and he is a person. And I think what happens with, you know, dead poets is that they're almost not allowed to be people, just a guy. I mean, you're just 24, you know, looking for a boyfriend.
Yeah.
Half the time, and it's almost like their humongous reputation doesn't allow for that. I just sort of did it anyway, and it was great fun. And, you know, that was what I was interested in, just making people and having telling something about life, my life.
The novel in the form or under the title When Auden Met Dora won the Ms. Lexia Prize.
Yes,
tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was, so that was still quite an early stage. I think we've lots of people who know how to write novels have looked at it. But yes, I think that's a really important thing to do when you're alone with an enormous project like writing a novel, to find out if it's working, to enter it into things, to get that sort of validation. And it was basically the same shape, but it hadn't... I entered that anonymously because I didn't... I mean, I'm sure that, you know, they wouldn't know me, but I didn't want there to be any idea that, you know, that they might have heard of me because I'm a poet. And it was a really wonderful thing to happen. That's yes, I can do it. Yeah. And that's different from, you know, other people reading it and saying, well done, you know. It is actually, yes, I have actually written a novel. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And a novel that Louis de Bernier has a blurb on. So that's an impressive blurb. How'd that happen?
Is. Well, I sent him some... I met him once about 15 years ago. So, I mean, you have to do everything you can for your book. And, you know, when the prospect of it being published came up, these things really matter. People wanting to write blurbs for it makes all the difference in the world, you know. So I did spend a really hard weekend, you know, trying to remember every famous writer I'd ever met and then bothering them. So, but I'm sort of used to it. I mean, poets are, you know, used to kind of knockbacks and, you know, general humiliation. So it was very hard to do, but I did. I wrote to him and sent him a bit of it, and he was actually what he did was rang me straight up and just said, you can't send me just 50 pages. I've got to see it all now. Which I thought was probably a good sign. Yeah.
Thank you, Polly. I want to end our little time together by you reading from Thank You, which is
the last part, the last stanza of a very short poem I wrote called Thank You, which is included in the book, actually is something that Dora wrote, so squeezed in one of my own poems. All the sadness of the hills was on fire. The swan galleons set sail across the grey, and I ran the length of the loch to press into your hands this for the shining silver of my life.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.